Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. My name is Ted Mitchell, and I'm the president of the American Council on Education, representing over 1,200 of the nation's colleges and universities, two-year, four-year, public, and private. And we're here today to talk about something that draws all of those institutions together, and that's teaching. But to join me is my really good friend, longtime colleague, my boss, a member of my board, Paul LeBlanc, who is the president of Southern New Hampshire University. And as all of you know, Southern New Hampshire is one of the most innovative, fastest growing, and impactful institutions in America. Paul has led Southern New Hampshire well and clearly, and has been not only a man who's committed to innovation in higher education, but to really the high ethical and moral purposes of what brought us all to this profession. And so, Paul, it's a pleasure to have you with me today to talk about teaching in the context of what's going on in higher education. And to note, as we go into the conversation, that we're brought together by our good colleagues at AQ, the Association of College and University Educators, who do one thing, and that is try to scale up great teaching across American colleges and universities. But we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Paul, you know, given the public perception about the value of a college degree, a lot of times this becomes very reductionist, and people talk about the ROI of a college degree and what's this good for and where is the knowledge going to lead me. But you know, you've been very articulate for a very, very long time about the need for us to look at an education as something broader than that. And so today I think we'll be able to talk about that from three different perspectives: the student experience, the faculty experience, and the important issue of student belonging, which is, I think, something that goes by the wayside when we take an incrementalist approach and an instrumentalist approach to higher education and teaching and learning. So I think in our conversations leading up to this, Paul, and this is not just around leading up to this event, but leading through our careers, I think you and I come to this with one point of great commonality, and that is that scaling great teaching is at the heart of the matter when we think about student success and when we think about the important role of higher education in society. So let's dive in. It's been a tumultuous few years, COVID, issues of racial equity, diversity, inclusion. It's been an important several years for higher education. And a couple questions, because you've been riding the crest of this wave. How's the role of the faculty changed? And how are we asking faculty to support students in perhaps ways that they haven't before?
God, first of all, it's always great to be with you, Ted. And these are the most important questions you and I talk about in our work. So when you think about this question of education as fundamentally transformative, right? When we remind ourselves that this is about transformation, and as you say, our discourse is often centered on a pretty instrumentalist question, which is, what is the alignment of higher ed and workforce? And that's really important. Like, we get it. But higher education doesn't do just one job. And while students come to us, and in every survey, it's confirmed again and again, what they say is they come for access to meaningful work and a good career that will pay them. And in a world that where the inequities seem broader than ever, and crueler in many ways than ever, there's almost a Darwinian desperation to make sure to find reassurance that your degree will lead to a job, because that's what matters, right? That's the difference between being able to take really good care of your kids and yourself and not. But we also know that it's about so much more. And I see this at graduation every May, because our students are overwhelming. You know, those 30-year-olds who tried college, they've got typically credits from multiple schools. They don't have a degree, but they have debt from their previous attempts. And now they've come back because they've been stuck, and they need to unlock this opportunity. So when I ask them at graduation, why did you do this thing, this very hard thing? You got a job, you got kids, you got a lot going on in your life. They always say, first, I needed to get a better job. But in the same breath, and I want my kids to be proud of me. I want my daughter to know that her mom, her dad, was a college graduate. I wanted to be a role model. I wanted to make my parents proud of me. My dad's passed away, but I like to think he's looking down on me right now and knows that I did this thing I promised him I'd do someday. These are big, fundamentally transformative experiences that we give people. And along the way, the data's clear, that are clear that, you know, we're likely to sort of see, you know, more civic engagement, lower rates of smoking, like all the things that correlate. Those are really important. In that transformative work, I think we always ask faculty to be the creators, conveyors, and curators of knowledge, to be in that classroom and sort of, you know, for a long time, fill those empty vessels. And then, of course, we've long moved past that model. We've understood that learning happens best when it's active and kinetic and proactive and engaged and relevant. And, you know, I think it's easy for critics of higher ed to say, to make fun of Sage on the stage teaching. But if I walk through a classroom today, I don't see a ton of that anymore. There's some of it, like, you know, the big lecture calls that go with pre-med, for example. Okay, there's still some of that going on. But really what I see are faculty who have really responded to the good work on sort of, you know, learning science and what we know about the way students learn and understanding. So that's evolved. But a number of things have happened, as you said. What's happened in the recent years to change things? The following, I would say. Well, let's say the obvious one, the pandemic, writ large, right? So, you know, I'm not sure that I love the prescriptions in this well-known article that was published in the New York Times earlier this year, the title of which was The Kids Are Not All Right.
Right.
But you know, the point of the article was not only do we lose 1.4 million students out of the system, but those who did come back or those who kept coming, they weren't good. And I worry about the levels of mental health, depression, you know, 1 in 5 college students reporting suicide ideation in the last 12 months. These are the people who are now sitting in front of our faculty, and the challenge is enormous. It's a challenge of, first of all, and we've had this conversation with faculty, you know what? The question, the day no longer opens up with how was the homework or how was the assignment. The first question has to be, how are you? Are you okay? And I think that personal connection, I think there is, and this is so hard because our faculty are tired, right? They were traumatized by this pandemic. And yet I think they have to be emotionally available to their students in a way that I think all the best faculty always have been, but now the need is more pronounced. And what does that mean? How do we think about that? And then I think we have to look at, it's one thing to recognize that, but to recognize that the trauma that many students carry with them, whether it's the sort of, you know, the sort of high schooler who was deprived 2 years of that social, like, is there a more social critter in America than a 17-year-old? No, right? And yet they were deprived of that. But it can be all the other kinds of trauma that many of our students have carried with them. And I think, you know, after George Floyd's murder, you mentioned this in passing, we did trauma-informed counseling practices for all our people, because what we realized is they were now dealing with stuff that they really hadn't dealt with so much before, or it came in, you know, it sort of surfaced with an individual student, but now you have a classroom of students who are carrying those burdens. So I think that's one piece that is the most obvious and immediate, is that we have faculty who face the challenge of students who, you know, we're in the middle of it. We still don't fully understand the impact. It's, you know, I think if you read Pale Rider, that wonderful 2016 book about the flu epidemic of 1917-18, you know, if there was one takeaway from that book is that society doesn't go back, and it takes a long time to know in what ways it's changed, but we all feel it. So faculty are now, you know, for our experienced faculty, they were the experts, man. You put them in a classroom, they knew their moves. They had their toolkit. They knew how to operate. And I think a lot of what I'm hearing now is I don't feel as sure-footed anymore. Like, I don't quite understand what's going on here. I sat in on a recent class. They're one of our most gifted faculty. He was great. And he was working so hard. And those students were so, I was like, what's wrong? I want to call a timeout. Like, why aren't you guys leaning in more? You can't get better than what's happening right now in this room. And it wasn't a lecture. We were sitting in a circle. Now, look, he said later, it could be me, right? It could be the president's here. I'm not saying anything in this room. So I think there's that challenge. I think there's another challenge, which is that our learners now, this is the first generation, at least our more traditional age learners, first generation of those who have grown up with ubiquitous technology.
Right.
You and I and our generation and most of our faculty will still say something like, hey, I'm going to go online and X, whatever, order things, look at a thing, check a thing. This is generations never offline. They don't have an online, offline world. They have an integrated. Now, it's not multitasking. We know that that doesn't really work, but they are fully in that space, right? So when I look at our enrollments of about 180,000 students, for the first time, we've seen this big jump in traditional age students. 30,000 17 to 22-year-olds are now enrolled with us. And I think some of that is, hey, during the pandemic, we discovered online works for me. You know, the first year of the pandemic, do you remember the everywhere you look, there was a phrase like, we're in it together. Like, we'll get through this together.
Right.
By year two, it's like, get out of my goddamn space, right? Like, there was this, like, nerves were frayed. And I think the political heat on every part of the spectrum, my own politics are progressive. But so when I, you know, when we talk about this very fraught time around, what we live around race, sexual identity, reproductive rights, et cetera, particularly around things like race and sexual orientation and gender identity, I hear a lot of faculty who are good, well-meaning people say, too scary, third rail. I don't know how to have that conversation. I don't want to get in trouble. Don't want to bring it up. And yet, if you're a student who's feeling the trauma of being a trans student, for example, where you're feeling attacked in a way you never have before, or you're a Black student who's watched yet again another police murder of an unarmed Black man at a traffic stop, as we saw last week, how do you not have that teacher engage with you on this thing that feels so much more important than differential equations, the topic of the day? So we're asking so much of our faculty, and I think this is where training, AQ's work, the work that you all are doing, ACE, like faculty are being asked to do so much more with so far fewer tools that feel familiar. And that's a major gap that I think the work you're helping lead, Ted, can help us address.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, Paul, you're speaking so eloquently about the transformative power of education and how central the relationship between faculty and students is in that. And, you know, you talked about surveys earlier. If you look at the surveys at the other end and about what matters to students during their college years, it's the idea that they can develop at least one strong relationship with a member of the faculty or an administrator in some cases, with whom they can be a whole person.
And absolutely.
Right. And I think that that's what you're talking about. And I think that that is, on the one hand, it's a reinforcement of all of the very best that we've known about higher education. You and I can certainly point to those engagements with people in our lives. But I think we've all been put on notice that we've got to focus on that. We need to foreground that in ways that we haven't before. And I think how we manage that is going to be the answer to the question, what's going to be permanent about the change that these three forces that you mentioned come to bear. So I think that that's right on target. And a personal note: you were kind enough to invite me to speak at an SNHU graduation, and the feeling there of intergenerational community transformation that radiated from the person who is receiving the degree, up and down through their family, to parents, to children, and to members of the broader communities of which they're a part, is absolutely spectacular. And, you know, we get a lot of heat about what we do and don't do, but, you know, anybody who comes to that kind of commencement, to one of your commencements, for example, will not leave believing that higher education doesn't matter.
Yeah, so, thank you, Ted. I agree with you completely. And when you walk through the world as a college student, you walk through the world differently. When you walk through the world as a college graduate, you walk through this world differently. And I think because there are so many other pressures on the work we do, we can sometimes forget this very existential, fundamental, transformative thing that happens when people are successful in this way.
That's right. That's right. Well, you mentioned it at the a couple paragraphs ago, but if all of the above is true, then we really are putting a lot of weight on the faculty in places where they don't have a lot of muscle memory. And so how do you think we should go about this? You mentioned the STAR faculty member who was a little bit off speed, faced with sort of students who bring forward more things that he or she needs to deal with. You talked about faculty who were conscious of avoiding third rails that would put them at risk, and even if not professionally, personally, on the spot in ways that in the armor of "I just teach chemistry" has, you know, used to prevent us from having to deal with. How can we begin to support faculty at scale to develop these muscles, to interact with each other as a part of a community of learning about what the new normal will be for the faculty experience?
So I think we've touched on one, which is that there's enormous sort of training needs that have to happen. We have to equip people with more tools in their toolbox than they've historically needed to have. So I think that's one, and this is a place, for example, where we're working with AQ right now. And, you know, the beauty of that work is that the thing I learned today, I get to put to work tomorrow. Like, it's immediate. And honestly, I've never heard faculty gush about a professional development experience the way they talk about this. And I think, you know, so that's a testimony to the quality of the courses and the workshop and the development. But it's also, I think, speaks pretty eloquent to the depth of the need, right? If you are dying of thirst, that first glass of water never tasted better. You know,
that's right.
If you are struggling in your classroom, if you're that poor guy that I mentioned a moment ago who was struggling with a student who's a superb teacher, give me some new tools. Help me, please. Because faculty care deeply. No faculty, you know, wants to come out of a classroom feeling like that was flat. Like, that's just demoralizing. So that kind of training, I think, is critical. You said a second word, which I hadn't mentioned, which is, I think, finding community. We now collectively need to learn together. It's never been more important that individuals sort of take, I mean, the world is changing so much. All of our ends of one, like one person is not, like, we got to collectively be in a community of practice. And I think, again, this is what, and now I'm in a course together, I'm with colleagues, I'm hearing them describe their challenges. Part of it is it validates my own work, and also my challenges don't feel like it's about me, it's about something bigger, but it's also inspiring, it's role modeling, et cetera. And I do think that that's critical. I think there's some other macro level things we have to do. I mean, still too much of higher education rewards that which is not about students, right? If you just take a look at how much time and resources we squander on other things. And I would even say, you know, I spent a year writing this book called Broken, which looks at scale systems of care and looking at other industries. And even in a place that centers human relationship as strongly as SNHU does, like, that's where we plant our flag more than anything else. When I ask our people who work directly with students, what percentage of your day is spent on satisfying the needs of our system versus the needs of our students? I don't like the answer.
Right.
How much time are they filling in forms? How much time are they entering data? And all of that stuff helps us run the system better. But running the system better is not the same as transforming the individual life of a student who needs to be with you in this moment. And
a better system is not necessarily one that is more super efficient, right?
No, as a matter of fact, if I would say anything, you know, we have allowed super efficiency, what we describe efficiency, to trump outcomes.
Exactly.
So we have, you know, this in the US, we spend more money per capita on healthcare than any country in the world, and our outcomes are not great. In fact, they're abysmal in some instances. So efficiency is not really the driver here, I think. And part of, you know, we live in an era in which we are so focused on technology, which really wants clean, replicable processes, clean segmentation, like the, you know, unstructured data is messy in a world of technology, but human beings are unstructured and messy. So having a system that's agile and responsive and make sure that we keep humans where they need to be is really critical. And
I think,
look, at the heart of it, most of our learners are still thinking about their faculty. They're still thinking about the human relationship. And you said it. Now, Matt Beal, who's the head of child and adolescent psychology at Georgetown's MedStar Center, I interviewed him for the book, and I said, you know, Matt, in really terrible context, we see some young people make it, while so many others don't? What have we learned about those who make it? Like, where does resiliency lie in that case? And if I think about that in a higher ed kind, it's like, you know, who gets across the finish line and who doesn't? We still lose too many people in our industry and at SNHU. What characterizes, he said, resiliency, there's a lot there. But if you really boil it down, it's three things. And you mentioned the key one, Ted. So the first one is, you know, can you spark an interest? Almost any interest. So when you get someone in the right major and the right program, that one course, like, oh my God, I didn't realize that poetry actually is a lot more like the hip hop lyrics I like than I thought, and blah, blah, blah. Now I'm connected and I want to learn more. So hooking, you know, sparking, lighting a match under that flame of interest. Second one is that they have some vision of better. So in the second chapter of my book, I have a chapter called, you know, aspiration. Like, part of our job is to help students dream bigger dreams for themselves. When I was a first gen kid, I didn't know what was possible.
Right.
And I had a mentor, a teacher, who said, no, this, right? He lifted my sights. But Matt would say the third item is the single most important thing. You touched upon it. You need at least one person who believes in you.
Yep.
Who knows you in your complexity as a human being.
Yep.
So it's not always the teacher relationship in the classroom. Certainly there, but sometimes it's the out of the classroom. Sometimes it's the, hey, Ted, step in my office for a moment. You seem out of sorts. What's going on? You told me about X. Like that. And the thing you can't do in that context, there's the one thing you can't get efficient about. You can't shortchange time.
Right. Right.
Like all of your great mentors found time for you.
That's right.
All of my great mentors made time for me. And that's the critical thing.
So, you know, Paul, this is incredible. And what I hear you saying is that these kinds of encouraging and developing skills around these kinds of interactions aren't optional. If they ever were, they're certainly not now. And that building a community of learners among the faculty about how best to do that, using a system to create more space for those kinds of interactions. I love what you said about the technology making, serving those interactions rather than coming at the expense of those interactions. I think that's exactly right. And the idea that if that works, there will more students at a higher rate will get through manifest the transitions that transformation we talked about in higher education. You know, I was looking at some of the AQ meta-analysis a couple of weeks ago, just recent analysis, and it does show that when faculty learn these evidence-based practices that you were talking about, students do better, they stay in school longer, and equity gaps close because people are seen in the complexity that they bring to the endeavor, not, you know, as a vessel to be filled. And I think that's incredible. You know, think about an AQ certified faculty member essentially retains two additional students per year. And if you think about that from a student point of view, those are two people whose pathways will continue to expand as a result of their higher ed experience. Let me make a transition from the faculty to this idea that has come through loud and clear in everything that you've said, and that's about belonging. It's about faculty belonging. It's about student belonging. I think that if we were to strip you of your title for a moment and just have you be Paul LeBlanc, wise man, and I were to play this recording to my former colleagues at Occidental College, very small liberal arts college in Los Angeles, they would say, yeah, that's what we do. That's why you have small liberal arts colleges. But you're talking about and from an experience base of an institution that is at the exact opposite side of the scale equation. You know, the entire Occidental faculty, the entire Occidental alumni group is at the size of one of your classes. So what's the magic of taking this intimate scale and redefining it as infinite scope? as an institution grows, it becomes more complex, integrates technology. How do you foster that sense of belonging?
Yeah, so I'm going to, I will agree with your term and do an and, because I think it's, we can belong to lots of things that don't make us feel like we matter. Like I belong to professional associations and they get my yearly check and I value the publication, I value the conference, but I don't get the sense that I matter to them.
Yeah.
So I like mattering a little bit better than belonging. And I know you're using belonging the same way. So we are in radical agreement on the notion.
Yep. Yep.
So mattering starts with this notion that you know me inside, right? That, and you know, it's sort of like when you meet someone for the first time, whatever the context is, and it happens once in a while, we go, wow, like that person really gets me. What does that really mean? Right. When a student sort of encounters a faculty or staff member and says, wow, they really got me. It means that person was able to go past the surface.
Right.
So one of the things we struggle with, and it's where we think about scale, is what in all of our interactions, can we capture an understanding of the student that allows us to know them in greater complexity than simply, oh, second year student majoring in finance, blah, 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 a veteran. Like that's the level, but you know, if I am all of that and also Black or Native American or Hispanic, more complexity. If I am Black and gay, more complexity. If I'm Black, gay, and a veteran, more complexity. And when I have encounters, and for us, it's you know, faculty and advisors who know me at that level of complexity, who when the call starts not with how that exam go, but hey, you said last time we talked that your little girl was really struggling with bronchitis. Is she feeling better? Now, all of a sudden, it's like you're seeing me first as a human being, which then allows me to have a more meaningful conversation with you as a student. So part of the go to your question of how do we do this challenge? Like, so one of the challenges is that what I describe, what we'd ideally like to do, doesn't happen easily in the way that higher ed technology exists today. Our legacy systems are very much siloed and they don't talk well together. They don't play well together. So we have a 22 million dollar investment right now with Google in this instance to build a new underlying data infrastructure upon which we can build applications with much better sharing of data. And I think that's the sort of thing from a technology perspective that's critical. Second thing is if you and I are right and that those critical conversations between faculty and students, staff and students, all of our humans, if those are really the most important part of creating a sense of belonging / mattering, then how do I make sure that I know which ones matter most? Right. How do I hold that space sacred? And then how do I get more things off the plate so that our people can have more time for the things that matter? So if we're going to ask faculty to do more of that, you know what? I've never met a faculty member who said, I really love assessment. Like I want to do more assessment. I was a writing teacher, a writing professor. It was torture sometimes, to be honest with you. Now, giving feedback on writing was my critical vehicle and channel in that instance for helping improve the craft. It is a craft. But it, to the extent that we can do more automation of assessment and take assessment off the faculty plate to give them more time for relationship, I think that's a critical piece. I think the tools that you talked about, you know, evidence-based tools that give people better tactics, better behaviors. I think all of these are really critical to doing this at scale. And then I think I alluded to this earlier, but I don't know if you, I'm sure you're familiar with David Graeber's work. I love the fact that he was an anarchist economist, but he was, you know, the kind of the brilliance behind the Occupy Wall Street movement. But his last book before he died was called Bullshit Jobs. Sorry, forgive me the title. But it is what it was. But you know what he shows, what the research shows, is that something like 60% of people globally think they could stop doing their job tomorrow and no one would even notice. Pretty dismal. In the U.S., mm-hmm. It's lower. It's about 35%. Still pretty high. But the other question he looks at is what percentage of your job doesn't matter.
Right.
And I think we burden our people with way too much stuff that doesn't matter to the fundamental work. So to our earlier point, right? We satisfy the needs of the system, but I don't know that it actually matters. So we're really looking hard at our own bureaucracy. Are the things we ask, like we ask our faculty to do an annual sort of scholarly plan. Well, that's a lot. Like, really? Is that like annually we have to revisit that? A lot of that work is the work of multi-years. Don't we trust them? They're professional. Like, so we're looking at these things like, can we just get some things off the plate? I know they satisfy the system, but are they good for the students? Are they good for the people who need to do the work?
Yeah, and I think you're really, again, if the topic today is getting to the heart of the matter, I think you've done it in spades here, Paul, with you know, thinking about mattering and you know, how can we construct institutions, how can we organize systems around making it possible, desirable, doable for the adults in the room, and I use that as a positional rather than an age-based thing. To open themselves and be able to open themselves to providing support and help to individuals who are not as advanced on the path, yeah. To help, you know, bring them up. And I think that that's a faculty and helping administrator to student relationship. I also think it's important that it's a faculty to faculty relationship, because faculty themselves are going to be at different stages of their development. But thinking about the opening, the openness, the loving, the support, the kind of thing that we would do with a sibling or a son or a daughter, someone who was already in a relationship with us in which some things were presumed, like respect, affection, regard, and making sure that we can get people there and then build on that. To encourage the transitions that we're talking about.
Wholly agree. And I think when I think about the work we do with our faculty and our staff, but with our folks a little bit more on faculty in this conversation, I'm also reminded of, you know, Greg Elliott, who's this wonderful sociologist at Brown, who really tutored me in this notion of mattering and the research behind mattering and its importance, would say the true mattering requires three things. And now we've been talking about students, but let's talk about faculty for a moment. The three things Greg would say is that for me to feel like I matter, to feel like I'm valued, you need to know me. So the kind of things we've been talking about,
right.
You need to invest in me. That's yep. Kind of caretaking, right? And then the third is you have to value what I do. In other words, if you only do the first two, I really know you and I'm going to do a whole bunch of things where you feel like I'm investing in you, but you don't get to then manifest or have agency in your impact, I feel like I matter less. When we treat people well, when we really support and treat our faculty well, I just fundamentally believe they are going to treat our students more,
yes,
better,
yep,
more effectively, right? And at SNU, I'm very proud of the fact that we're the one university in America that's been on the Chronicle's Best Colleges to Work For list every single year since it was created. And I know that sounds immodest, but my point in that is that I think we have really good results with students because we do really good work with the people who work with students.
Right.
And I think it transfers over.
And I know that to be true, knowing multiple members of your faculty and seeing them at work. And I also know that it's true that one of the reasons that this partnership we're displaying right now between SNU and AQ and ACE is so genuine, is that I think that the work that AQ does with faculty starts from the place we've been discussing,
yeah,
of making sure that faculty know that they matter, that they matter to each other as colleagues, they matter to the system, but most importantly, they matter to students. And I think if it all comes from that, as you say, it builds on each other. The people who are supported support others. People who have the skills and techniques to support others are able to teach those to other people. And I think that it really is the case that what we've been talking about today is at the heart of the matter. We're at the end of our time, Paul, and you and I could go on for hours, and I would be smarter at the end of the time. But I think we have to cut this off. I want to thank you for spending the time with us today. I want to thank you for your incredible leadership at SNU and your incredible thought leadership with your writing and your speaking across the country and really across the world. You're a gem, you're a treasure, to higher education. And it's been an honor to be with you today.
Oh, well, you're so kind, Ted. Thank you so much. That's beyond generous. And really, in the end, there's so many of us who are all working this together. It's a privilege and honor to be in this work with you and with our colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you.